Never go to the second location. Always trust your gut.
Hello, my name is Chrissy Champagne. You are listening to Residue, a true crime podcast dedicated to keeping you paranoid. Residue is not just another true crime podcast, but a necessary tool for those who want to understand the dangers lurking in the real world. Residue is created, hosted, edited, researched, and produced by me, Chrissy Champagne. Before we begin today's story, do not forget to hit that follow button. And I learned a new song for you guys today. I will follow you way down, wherever you may go. I'll follow you way down to your deepest low. And speaking of, I do want to say hello and thank you to all of my new followers. And hello and thank you to all of my OGs. I love all of y'all. You know that I appreciate you all so much. And also, the very best thing that you could possibly do for any podcast that you love is leave a 5-star review. You can also follow me on Instagram at Residue Podcast, on TikTok at Residue Podcast, or Facebook Residue, a true crime podcast. But before we begin today's episode, as always, listener discretion is advised. Made-for-TV movies, often called television films or telefilms, are movies produced specifically to be broadcast on television rather than released in theaters. And since their rise in popularity during the 60s and 70s, these films have become a unique and influential part of our entertainment landscape. Unlike theatrical releases, made-for-TV movies often focus on timely, socially relevant, or sensational topics that grab viewers' attention and spark conversation from the comfort of their living rooms. One of the key strengths of made-for-TV movies is their ability to tell compelling stories on a modest budget, which often leads to creative storytelling and very strong performances. Many of these films explore real-life events, true crime, biographical stories, and they aim to educate as much as entertain. And because they air on network or cable channels, these movies tend to reach a broad and diverse audience, making complex issues more accessible and opening up important conversations. And so, in the past on Residue, we have talked about a couple made-for-TV movies that were actually based on true crimes. So we had the Missy Avila murder that we covered, also the Tracy Thurman story, and now today we're going to be covering the story of Lori Kellogg. And the movie that was made about Lori was called Lies of the Heart, the story of Lori Kellogg. Lies of the Heart, the story of Lori Kellogg, is a 1994 American made-for-television crime drama film, and this film is based on actual events, but it was received with mixed reviews. So critics praised the film and its emotional depth, and they highlighted Jenny Garth's performance as Lori Kellogg. You know, our loved Kelly from 90210. However, some felt that the film's execution didn't fully do justice to the gravity of the real-life events that it portrayed. And despite its critical reception, the film serves as a poignant portrayal of the devastating effects of domestic violence and the complexities surrounding cases of abuse and injustice. This movie sent a message, and while listening to Lori's story, we have to remember that living with domestic abuse is like carrying an invisible weight. One that grows heavier with every insult, every threat, every moment of control. It's not just bruises or raised voices. It's that quiet fear of doing the wrong thing, of saying the wrong word, of existing in a way that might trigger someone else's rage. Over time, it wears you down. It wears down your sense of self. You stop trusting your own instincts. You begin to believe that maybe you deserve it, that maybe this is just how love looks for you. Escaping that kind of abuse isn't just about walking out the door. It's about breaking free from a story you've been told over and over that you're weak, that you're worthless, that you can't survive on your own. It takes courage to leave, But it takes even more strength to stay gone, to rebuild your life brick by brick. And for so many, that courage has to come in secret, in silence, in moments when no one is watching, because surviving abuse is more than getting away. It's reclaiming your voice, your safety, your right to be whole again. Lori Lee Feinstein was born on August 16, 1964 in New York City. When she was 2 years old, she moved with her mother, Linda Francis, to Holyoke, Massachusetts. There, Lori grew up with her brother, Billy, raised by her mother and her stepfather, Ed Francis. As a teenager, Lori babysat children in the neighborhood and earned a reputation as the caring neighborhood nanny. Lori Kellogg says that in childhood, her father sexually abused her, masturbated in front of her, and introduced her to pornography and sex toys. And she says that her father also physically and mentally abused her mother. Her childhood was just marked by instability. After her parents divorced, her mother remarried a man with a gambling habit, and the family moved frequently. By her teenage years, Lori was living in a trailer park near a racetrack in Grantville, Pennsylvania. At just 16 years old, she met 33-year-old Bruce Kellogg, a married man with two children, at a local bar. And the two began a relationship. Now, Lori is 16. This man is a 33-year-old man with two kids, married. We don't call this a relationship. Following a falling out with her mother in October 1981, Lori moved in with Bruce, 33-year-old Bruce. He eventually divorced his wife in 1987, and Lori and Bruce married, settling into a modest gray Cape Cod home in a suburb of Harrisburg. Now, there is not a lot of info on this case, and I find it very difficult to talk about this case because it's just so heartbreaking that Lori had no one. I mean, who's looking out for this child? She shouldn't have been in a bar at 16. She shouldn't have been hanging out with a 33-year-old abusive man. And she definitely shouldn't have been marrying him at age 17. It just angers me that nobody fucking stood up for Lori. And then Bruce, who had grown up on a farm in Cayuga County. He worked as a successful customer service supervisor for a heating and air conditioning company. And Lori pursued her education, attending community college and later graduating from Penn State with a degree in elementary education. Together, they had two sons and appeared, at least from the outside, to be a loving and stable family. And this is something I found in research. I'm not saying that they looked like a loving and stable family because I'm not sure what people were telling others that these two looked like a loving and stable family, the 16-year-old marrying the 33-year-old. I'm thinking that right away it didn't look right. But not every neighbor thought that they looked adorable. There were others that saw a dark side, and many said that they saw Lori with a black eye, a gash on her head, bite marks and bruises, and they knew that these were all the result of her husband's abuse. According to a 2017 Syracuse.com article, Lori did confide in friends that Bruce was abusive. He raped her. He sodomized her. He would put a gun in her mouth while he was doing these things. Lori alleges that Bruce subjected her to severe physical, sexual, and psychological abuse. Beatings resulting in broken bones, concussions and hearing loss, miscarriages and reconstructive jaw surgeries, rape, forced sexual acts involving threats with a loaded gun. Lori ends up finding companionship in a group of teenagers from the neighborhood. Now, it is said that Lori allowed these teens to hang out in her home, and she would often go out to the local roller skating rink with them. And they would say that Lori stood out at the roller skating rink because she was a bit older than all of the teenagers now. They were around 14 years old, average age at this roller skating rink. And at the time, Lori was 26. I just feel like Lori was forced into this horrific marriage at such a young age, at 16, that's maybe where she was stuck mentally. I mean, she never had a childhood. She never experienced her teen years. And amongst these teenagers that Lori was hanging out with, she meets Denver McDowell. Denver McDowell was just 17 when he became part of a story far bigger and darker than he ever expected. A teenager from Pennsylvania, Denver was drawn into the world of Lori Kellogg, a young woman whose life seemed complicated, troubled, and difficult to understand. To Denver and a few of his friends, Lori was someone they looked up to, someone who confided in them and trusted them. She talked about the challenges she was facing in her marriage, painting a picture of desperation and pain. And this group of teens began to feel protective of her, convinced they needed to do something. On June 9th, 1991, Denver accompanied Lori and others on a trip to a cottage in New York. Denver would later say that at the time, he did not fully understand the weight of what he was doing. He was 17, and what started as loyalty turned into a tragic decision that had permanent consequences. Denver McDowell actually spoke to Syracuse.com in 2017 and described exactly how the murder of Bruce Kellogg went down. He says that him, Lori, and four teenagers were all involved in the killing, and they all lived near Lingelstown, PA. It was a suburb of Harrisburg, PA. Now, Denver admits to Syracuse.com that he did not just commit this murder for Lori. He did this for his girlfriend. Now, he had a girlfriend named Nikki, and the day before the murder, Denver's girlfriend Nikki came to him and told him that while she was at Bruce and Lori's house being babysat, Bruce sexually molested her. Denver just couldn't wrap his mind around everything he is now hearing about this man, Bruce. So, Bruce Kellogg was this big game hunter, and that's why he had a hunting cabin up in the Finger Lakes. He also had a huge gun collection, and this consisted of rifles, shotguns, handguns, and Denver knew about all of these weapons. So while he was at the Kellogg's house one night, he stole a .41 caliber Magnum revolver from Bruce. And Denver had a long history of crime. He wasn't an angel. Denver was in and out of jail numerous times, and he also had a history with drugs. So the night of the murder, four teenagers with Lori driving drive up to the cabin. While they're driving up, Denver shows everyone that he has a gun. They pull up to the cabin. They jump out of the car, but Denver and his girlfriend, Nikki, are the two that run towards the cabin. Now Bruce is sleeping on the patio of the cabin. They run up to him and Denver shoots him in the head. Two days after the murder of Bruce Kellogg, state police would charge his wife, Lori, at the time age 26, and then the four teenagers that were along with her for the ride. After Denver shot Bruce, he threw the gun into the Cayuga Creek in Schuyler County, and someone found the gun the next day. They notify the sheriff's department. They find out that this gun belonged to Bruce Kellogg, and this led to the arrest of Lori and the teenagers. So the teenagers were identified as Denver McDowell and then Nicole Pappas, his girlfriend, age 16, Christy Mullins, age 15, and Charles Sebelist, age 16. And all of these teenagers were from Harrisburg County. Lori Kellogg's trial began on June 15, 1992, in the small town of Waterloo, New York, less than a year after the night Bruce Kellogg was shot in his sleep at a lakeside cottage. The courtroom was packed and the media was watching closely, and just 4 days into the trial, Denver McDowell took the stand. He was only 17 when it happened. Calmly, under oath, he admitted to killing Bruce. But his testimony turned toward Lori. He told the jury he had fallen in love with her and that she had confided in him about the abuse she said she suffered at Bruce's hands. And McDowell claimed Lori was afraid to leave her husband and that she made him feel as if doing something about it was the only way to protect her. A week later, Lori testified in her own defense. Her voice at times was strained and she described a different version of events. She said she wanted to confront Bruce the night of the shooting, to talk to him, not to harm him. But the teenagers, and especially Denver, they had their own plans. She told the jury they believed Bruce had harmed two other teenage girls and they acted on that belief without her direction. She maintained that she never asked for violence and that she only needed a way out. On July 2, 1992, the verdict was handed down. Lori Kellogg was convicted of second-degree murder, first-degree manslaughter, burglary, and multiple weapons charges. She was sentenced to 25 years to life. And throughout this trial and ever since, Lori has maintained her innocence. Denver McDowell pleaded guilty and he was sentenced to 50 years to life. But that was later reduced to 25 to life. Denver was denied parole in 2016. And according to a Syracuse.com 2017 article, Denver admitted that during his first few years in prison, he tried to take his own life several times. And he was placed in solitary confinement numerous times for fighting with other prisoners. He also told Syracuse.com that he met a girl from Kansas while in prison on an online dating site. She moved to Pennsylvania to be close to his family so that she could also visit Denver more often, and then the two married in a prison ceremony. But soon his new wife just disappeared. She vanished, and Denver said he would like to divorce her if only he could find her to serve her the papers. The three other teenagers were each charged with two counts of second-degree murder, first-degree burglary, second-degree conspiracy, and criminal use of a firearm. The three teenagers each pleaded guilty to various charges. Charles Sebelis pleaded guilty to second-degree criminal possession of a firearm, and he was sentenced to 5 to 15 years in prison. Nicole Pappas pleaded guilty to second-degree conspiracy and second-degree criminal possession of a firearm and was sentenced to 8 1/3 to 25 years in prison. And Christy Mullins was not tried as an adult and was in the custody of New York State Division for Youth Juvenile Facility until she turned 21. Lori Kellogg, who is now 60 years old, was released from prison in 2019. In the end, the question that still lingers is not just whether Lori Kellogg pulled the trigger, because she didn't, but whether she pulled the strings. Was she a calculating manipulator who used teenagers to carry out a murder that she didn't want to commit herself? Or was she a frightened young woman trapped in an abusive marriage, reaching out in desperation and losing control of what came next? Lori was 16 when she entered Bruce Kellogg's world. He was more than twice her age. Their relationship began in secrecy and imbalance, and by the time she was legally his wife, her life was already shaped by power dynamics that few teenagers could navigate. She told stories of control, fear, violence behind closed doors, stories that some believed and some did not. and the courtroom painted her as a seductress, a schemer. But to some, and especially those who understood the cycles of domestic abuse, Lori looked like something else. A girl who had been silenced for too long. Now, decades later, the truth still feels complicated. Maybe Lori Kellogg was both a victim and a participant. Maybe she bears responsibility, not because she intended death, but because she underestimated the consequences. Or maybe she was never in control at all, not even of her own life. Lori Kellogg was a teenager groomed by an older man, pulled from her youth and placed into a marriage where fear and control became part of her daily life. Justice isn't always as clear-cut as a verdict. And in Lori's case, what looked like guilt may have been the final act of a girl trying to survive the only way she knew how. Stay safe and stay paranoid.